From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Gorlott, the Dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies, and welcome to Worldviews. Michael Otim grew up during a tumultuous period in Uganda's history. Now he works in social justice to help those who have suffered.
At the time, so much was happening, and our people were really suffering. There was so much injustice ongoing. Human rights violations were so rampant, and I felt I needed to identify with them, and this was the time to be with them.
I'll talk with Michael Otim on today's show, but first, Rebecca Cruz and I will discuss impending soda taxes in Colombia and elsewhere, and the resulting harassment and threats.
This has gotten very, very nasty, and this all comes back to who is controlling things, and that has to do with the soda pop organizations.
That's all coming up after news from NPR. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gorlott. Rebecca Cruz, let's talk about Colombia this week. We've talked a little bit about some of the emerging stories that are coming out regarding the food industry and health. We had a discussion recently about Rio, and so now let's talk about Colombia. There's a recent report about how there's a proposed tax, 20% tax, that the legislature is considering on soda, on sugary drinks. And the head of the consumer advocacy group that is advocating for this tax because of the health consequences, obviously, in Colombia, diabetes and other health consequences that are resulting from massive consumption of these sugary beverages. We're very familiar with this issue, of course, in the United States as well, is being harassed and threatened. And it looks now like there's a battle over this and potentially even a violent one. Can you tell us kind of what's going on here in Colombia on this issue?
Well, as you said, this has to do with healthcare concerns, and we've talked a little bit about food and decreasing health in certain parts of the world, certainly globally, but in certain parts of the world, the developing countries. And in Latin America, this has certainly been an issue. And carbonated soft drinks or sugary drinks have been one of the main culprits that science has indicated is leading to cases of diabetes, et cetera. And if we think about Latin America, the sale of these carbonated soft drinks has doubled since 2000. The rate of diabetes has gone up significantly as well. So these laws or taxes have been proposed. But this has gotten very, very nasty. And this is in a country, of course, that is not new to nastiness. They have survived the drug wars and just recently have disarmed a terrorist organization in the FARC. So this may be kind of a new line that's causing some conflict. The organization that you mentioned that's advocating for this have been under a lot of pressure. The leader of the organization has been threatened. Others involved have been threatened. They are going to the police with these accusations. The police are not doing anything. The government has actually put in new laws that restrict them even talking about some of these situations. So $25,000 for bringing this up in a public venue. And this all comes back to who is controlling things. And that has to do with the soda pop organizations. And we often think of Coke and Pepsi, but in some cases, and here, we're talking about a domestic organization that has larger ties to other conglomeration that is involved in all sorts of activities. So we're talking about multi-million-dollar revenue here, and these companies are very, very invested in getting these people to be quiet.
Well, obviously, taxes mean a drop in sales, and so this is what they're talking about, right, is that these big soda companies are lobbying hard against these sorts of things. But this isn't just Colombia, as I mentioned. The United States has faced it. Mexico in 2014 imposed a 10% tax on sugary drinks. There's now a proposal to go to 20%. There's some harassment going on there as well. Russia, Germany, Israel, New Zealand, Saudi Arabia. I mean, they're around the world. People are considering, governments are considering these kinds of taxes in order to minimize the health consequences that are coming out. So once again, we're seeing a kind of a clash between the science of health and well-being and public policy and money on the side of big business.
Well, it's hard to say because we've got Russia and some other countries you mentioned. They've actually stalled their plans, but at least 30 countries have instituted theirs. And yeah, these sin taxes, they're very debatable. But as you said, we see them in our country. Seattle in January is going to have a similar tax, and Chicago just implemented one as well.
Well, interestingly, one of the lawyers working on this case in Colombia said that they feel like they've just gotten to the point where they're a normal country that can deal with issues other than violence, that this is considered a luxury to be able to talk about taxing soda. Anyway, thank you so much, Rebecca. We'll be paying attention to this issue in the future. Thanks
for
being here.
For sure. Thank you.
We'd love to hear your thoughts about this discussion or answer any questions you might have. Leave your comments in the Worldview section of KGOU.org. Or like us, follow us, and interact with us on Twitter. We're at WorldviewsKGOU, and I'm at Suzette Gwerlot. Next, I'll talk with Michael Oteam about transitional justice in Uganda. I'm Suzette Gwerlot, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Gwerlot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Michael Oteam is a civil society activist from Uganda. He is active in many humanitarian and social justice organizations in his home country, including the Uganda Fund and the Justice and Reconciliation Project. Michael Oteam, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you.
It's a pleasure to have you here. You came all the way from Uganda on short notice, and so we thank you for that, to participate in an event we had here on campus. And I just really want to start because you've engaged in a career-long level of work in justice, in the area of justice, social justice, and reconciliation. But can you tell us a little bit about yourself, your background, and kind of how you ended up getting into justice work? And then in particular, you've worked in the past on issues of transitional justice. Can you tell us what that is, what transitional justice is?
Yeah, thank you. I'm called Michael Oteam. I was born in Uganda. I started living in Uganda a few years back, but of course, as you know, it's a country that experienced a lot of political turmoil that sometimes compelled us to go into exile. I lived in exile in Kenya for some time, and during that time, I also lost my father, who was killed during Idi Amin's regime. And but later, when things slightly improved, we returned back to Uganda, and I studied in part in the north, but when the war started, we had to move out of the north and come down to the city. Now, given my past experiences, I've lived really in a society where there was a lot of violence, a lot of injustice, and this kind of inspired me to try and work for social justice. Especially when I look back and I see some of my friends whom we had either studied with, either lost their lives or because of circumstances dropped out of school, I felt I needed to give something back into the community. That's why I ended up in the humanitarian field and humanitarian doing development work, but also working on issues of human rights and justice. It's just because I felt at the time so much was happening and our people were really suffering. There was so much injustice ongoing. Human rights violations were so rampant. And I felt I needed to identify with them. And this was the time to be with them and work and to ensure, if possible, we can change the situation. And this is kind of what inspired me into the work that I currently do. And so because of that, I was able to found an organization called the Justice and Reconciliation Project, which started working on issues of local level transitional justice issues, looking at ways through which you help societies that have undergone systematic gross human rights abuses come to terms with what happened in the past. And of course, there's no one quick fix. There are a variety of ways. It could be holding perpetrators of human rights violation accountable through criminal prosecutions. It could be through engaging communities through a framework that unearth the truth. Countries like South Africa have established truth commissions. It could be through organizing, putting in place mechanisms that provide redress or reparations to acknowledge those who suffered harm and give them some form of compensation or some form of acknowledgement through apologies for the violations they went through. It could also involve using institutional reform. For instance, by reforming institutions that were responsible for the violations. For instance, if it was the military, then you've got to reform the military. If you had a corrupt judiciary, you need to, you know, remove all the bad apples and have the good guys working to restore confidence. It's about really restoring trust of people in their own institutions that govern them and manage their affairs.
Such fascinating and interesting and important and complicated work this must be. I mean, just listening to you outline all of the various ways that you go about engaging in this kind of work, and whether it's holding individuals accountable or reforming institutions, either way, it's not an easy task. But I want to, before I get to some more specifics about your work, I do want to pick up on the reconciliation part of your organization. And you talk so eloquently about truth-telling and accountability and reparations and, you know, making sure that those who've been harmed, you know, have some sort of justice. I'm curious, I've read a lot about this, how part of the reconciliation process has to do also with this very complicated thing we call forgiveness. And I was listening to you kind of, you know, wanting to see where to work that in is that it's so hard, right? Even if institutions are being reformed, even if individuals are being held accountable, even if you make these changes in order to address the harms of the past, that there has to be, do you think, some level of being able to move forward and forgiving what has happened?
Absolutely, you're absolutely right. And especially when you look at it from the angle of ultimately the goal we want is people to reconcile and forge a new future. But of course, reconciliation is a very complicated issue. It means different things. It's not a uniform interpretation, and it means different things to different people. It also doesn't mean that it's uniform in terms of when does it start for somebody and when do you end and you agree that reconciliation has actually happened. For instance, for some people, once a peace talk is signed, probably that's the beginning of reconciliation. For others, unless somebody, the perpetrator, seeks for forgiveness and issues an apology, that's when reconciliation can begin. For others, it would mean probably you come to me, say sorry, I shake your hand, that's when reconciliation can begin. For others, unless you compensate me, we will not talk. So it means different things for different people. And so, but ultimately, we want a reconciled community. It may not happen. And of course, also forgiveness. Forgiveness is a very personal thing, very, very personal. You can't compel somebody to forgive somebody who has not even sought remorse, for instance. Probably others, once somebody seeks, you know, shows remorse, probably that's when they can forgive. But you work local institutions to try and facilitate that so that there's a level of harmony in the community. And the kind of work that we do in Northern Uganda is that we try to support local institutions, those that are engaged in this kind of work, the religious institutions, the women's groups, the cultural institutions, the local leaders and others. We try because we know so much has already happened. So many lives were lost. You can't compensate all. There are so many perpetrators. You can't try all of them. And so many things that have happened. So we are saying, well, we are not saying the others are not important, but we are saying, well, let's start from somewhere. Let's facilitate a process that would lead to some level of social harmony. And then we can pick up from there and move the society forward.
Let's talk a little bit about some of the specific work that you do. Now, your organization is involved in grant making and supporting grassroots organizations. I think this is very important, right? You're working with victims of conflict. You're working with women, for example, that have been subjected to sexual violence during the war. In fact, much of your work has focused on women and youth and some of the organizations that are focused on the interests of women and youth. Can you tell us a little bit about why that focus and why it is that addressing the women that have been victimized by this war is particularly important?
Thank you. Yes, the organization that I currently work with is the Fund for War Affected Children and Youth, called the Uganda Fund. It's an international organization, but with the local chapter registered in Uganda. And our focus is working with young people. The Uganda Fund was established in 2006 with an initial 10-year commitment to support the recovery and the development of northern Uganda. Now, one of the areas or the niche we felt had been affected were the young people, including young women, young boys, children. This was a segment that was not being given any form of attention. This is the category of people who are abducted. These are the category of people who are forced into sexual slavery. These were people who are forced to commit heinous crimes. These are the people whose education was in jeopardy because they lost out in education because of the war. These are the group that are currently unemployed, who have no skills, and they're the majority. And what the Uganda Fund thought that this was an area that we needed to invest. We need to, that was just really a compelling case to prompt us to intervene and try to offer some support for this category of people, because we know that they are the future of the society. And if nothing is done about them, then the future of that society would be quite shaky. And so we took it upon ourselves to support a number of initiatives that would enable the young children or the young people take charge of their lives and also participate in the development of the country like any other participating citizen and contribute to the development of their country. And we started a number of programs. There were several that we did in the area of education, in the area of income generation and rural employment, in the area of justice and reconciliation. Several programs. I can say that over the 10 years, the Uganda Fund actually invested over $8 million in the Acholi sub-region and other parts of the country to support various enterprising initiatives that help change the lives of so many young people. And so currently, we are focusing largely on victims of conflict-related sexual and gender-based violence crimes. Women who are subject to sexual slavery in the rebel captivity, they have returned, their education was disrupted. More so, they are back reinserted in communities, they live in abject poverty, they have been rejected sometimes by their own parents or even relatives, they are on their own. They have children to look after. And we thought, well, we need to do something with them. We provide them grants. They establish different income-generating activities. They are currently running revolving loan schemes. We provide startup capital for small businesses for them. Others are engaged in agricultural activities like farming. Others engage in animal husbandry. They look after cattle, goats, and so on. They rear them for milk, as well as sell other items to earn income. And, they are participating in a variety of activities. And this is making them live in dignity, reclaim their space again, and many are beginning to be respected again in the community. Initially, they had nothing. Nobody would even pay attention to them. But some have already told us that, look, because they are now empowered, they are able to take care of their needs. Now people are seeing them as human beings. Initially, they were just looked at as rejects. We are proud that they're reclaiming their space in society.
Let's finish with this kind of the future. You know, where do you think, I mean, we know about Uganda's past. You've been telling us about what you're doing now. What do you expect for the future in terms of being able to reach a wider audience, about being able to continue work in institutional reform? What is the future hope we have in Uganda?
Of course, at the political level, we still have governance challenges. There's a segment of society, and especially those from the north and other places, who feel a little marginalized in terms of how the governance of our country is managed. There are certain people who feel that the government is not doing enough to address their plight. And there's a little bit of resentment towards government in that direction. And I think government really needs to do a lot in terms of restoring the confidence of the citizens, especially from those in conflict-affected regions, that they actually care and are willing to do enough to reverse the trend and the situation. But nonetheless, I think as organizations, yes, we have done our part. And of course, we also have our own limitations in terms of resources. We can't solve everything. This primarily should have been the responsibility of the government of Uganda towards its citizens. Unfortunately, they are not doing this job well enough. So our long-term hope is that we should be able to engage government to recognize that there is a section of its community that, if not helped or assisted or brought to the main fold, are losing out. And it's important that they take over full responsibility to ensure that they give hope to these people and ensure that they change the trend of things so that people can once again look at their government as one that cares, that can take care of their needs in terms of providing them services that should enable them also become active citizens in the affairs of their country. So this is how I probably look at the situation of the vulnerable communities in my country.
Thank you so much, Michael, for being here today and shedding some light on your situation in Uganda for us. Thank you.
Thank you.
You've been listening to my conversation with Michael Otien. He works on social justice and transitional justice issues in Uganda. Worldviews is produced in partnership between KGOU and the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma. Katie Holland prepares our research, Jacob McClellan edited this interview, and Sam Dupre produced the show. For Rebecca Cruz, I'm Suzette Rolette.